Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
As the leaders in this market start to crack and the market start to change, you're going to have that big reversion back to the mean into those commodities and real things, because that's what we need to pull off, you know, all of this great growth that they're claiming that we're going to have.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and I'm here with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management again. Paul, so good to see you.
Good to see you as well, Chris.
Well, here we are, middle of February, lots going on. Again, it feels like Lenin's statement, you know, where decades are happening in weeks now. It's very difficult to keep up, but one of the things that just popped up I want to talk about is, I call it the Mick Jobs report, to sort of tell you what I feel about it. It's so, our government reporting, Paul, is in a, it's really in a terrible state at this point in time. And our jobs report is part of that. And also, U.S. oil production has just slipped negative and there's oil revisions. I think this is finally starting to creep into the market. So I just wanted to talk about that. But maybe we could start with this. A surprising, they just announced a surprising 130,000 job gains today, Paul. Is amazing. January jobs, seasonally adjusted, 130,000. Now, if it wasn't seasonally adjusted, it was minus 2.649 million. Yeah. Heck of an adjustment.
Yeah. I mean, look, who besides the computers pays attention to the headline numbers now? You can only see it in the rearview mirror what actually happened.
Well, I mean, that was the headline. So let's peel it back a tiny bit. So it turns out, it's really just leisure and hospitality and health, private education and health services. Those are the growth areas. Everything else is sort of in retreat at this point in time. Again, these are seasonally adjusted, Paul, and their seasonal adjustments are for crap at this point. We can talk about that a little bit more. But my philosophy around this is meet the new boss, same as the old boss. I didn't like the jobs reports under Biden. Nothing has changed under Trump. They are tools of persuasion and communicating that I don't believe bear any resemblance to reality at this point, not based on talking to people about how hard it is to find jobs right now.
Correct. I'm hearing good the jobs. Same conversation. Yeah, good jobs. And it's even harder for the white collar individuals to replace their salaries, much less increase their salaries when they're moving. They're stuck in their jobs. They're not used to that. They've had the ability to move quickly and easily over the past 20 years. That environment has completely changed, at least on the conversations I'm having with people across the nation. So it's not limited to just one area. This is something that seems to be a consistent theme with individuals I'm talking to from California to Maine.
Yeah, and by the way, one sector, employment growth, it turns out, has been entirely due to this one sector, private education and healthcare. So that was plus 773 over the past year. Total payrolls was plus 359. So subtract those two, the rest of the economy shed 414,000 jobs. Private education and healthcare.
Yeah.
Like, how do those actually add value to our economy? Okay, private education, you need educated workforce. Okay. Mm-hmm. Healthcare, I consider to be a net negative in the sense that, yes, people have good paying jobs in those fields. But when you're taking care of sick people, that's not really a good thing that you have growth in that area, right? Oh, look how many more sick people we're taking care of. Not exactly a sign of strength. And so that's really quite profound that everything except private education and healthcare is in the tank over the past year. And that, of course, fits, I think, with what you just said, your anecdote that people are reporting. It's kind of hard to find a job.
That's right. And I would feel really good about it if that's manufacturing where you're creating jobs and people mm-hmm. are coming in. You make an investment, you're producing all of this extra revenue off of it. Yeah, the people that are in the healthcare industry are producing. But I mean, we can get to it maybe here in a little bit. But if you look at the wages for students that are graduating, they're declining now. Like, they're not coming out and getting higher salaries than what they were back in 2021. So So that's not producing this extra benefit like a manufacturing plant would be overall. At best, you're running even, but you're draining the reserves and going forward. And the education growth just doesn't make sense to me right now.
I want to get to that other data you mentioned about the declining salaries, because it's super important. I'll get to that in a minute. But if we think this first, Paul, I want to know how much of this private health care is the Somali fraud that's happening in Minnesota. How much of it is what we talked about, which is that 18%, one out of every $6 that goes into hospice care in the United States just flows into L.A. County, this little tiny dot on the map. Again, speaking to the obviousness that there's a huge amount of fraud there, I'll have to bet that there's a lot of fraud baked into that number. I don't know how much, but I'm going to bet a fair amount at this point in time.
That's a very good point. And if you're worried about propaganda, you really don't want that reality to come through, especially if it's going to hit your payroll report like that. I hate to be so cynical, but that's a great question.
Well, how is it that we haven't seen a single frog-marched person in handcuffs anywhere in L.A. County or in some in mini Somalia in Minnesota there or anywhere else in the country? These are obvious frauds. Paul, I think you could go in there with a competent team and arrest somebody in like 3 hours.
Absolutely. And I'm having more conversations with individuals around just the average individual, unsolicited, especially now that it's tax time and they're paying attention to how much they're having to pay in taxes and what they're sacrificing. Families that have got, you know, young kids, I was talking one the other day, they're like, with what I'm paying in taxes, let's just assume half of it is fraud. I could more than cover the education, child care costs for my kids, much less set aside enough money to make sure that I can set them up in the future or pay my house off. And there's a fury that's under the surface with people about that fraud, and especially the fact that there's no justice in it. I mean, it's pretty simple. Audit it and start arresting people and then go to trial quickly. But...
And by the way, this is something AI excels at. Auditing, it's amazing at it. You could just put AI on that, and you could probably unravel these things lickety-split. Slam dunk. I mean, easy, right? And then, this is the hard part, shutting, if there was $500 billion of fraud, take that out of the budget. Take it out, right? Mm-hmm. That's the part Washington never seems to be able to do. It's like, even if you find the fraud, they're like, well, then now we have extra money to spend on this other thing over here, you know? So,
right. Well, you know, my concern is, and I know this is cynical in my statement, but it sure feels very close to the truth, is we can see even with all the Epstein stuff, it's like, oh, we can't disclose it. It's going to destroy the government, the economy, all this stuff. Fine. If we're that fraudulent and we have to deal with it, let's just pick up the pieces on the other side. But my question is, and this is what I can't set aside, is the reason we're not digging into this fraud and really doing all these audits because it's going to be fine. We're going to find out that this is cycling through back into the pockets of these politicians that are building these amazing amounts of wealth. That has to be it. That's the only thing that makes sense to me.
Well, you look at it's gotten really bad in the last 5 years, too, how rapidly wealthy people in Congress have gotten, right? And they like to say it's, oh, because they have inside information on stock trading. And we could all say that maybe is inappropriate because you and I would get arrested for insider stock trading, that those laws apply to everybody but Congress. But it can't just be that. I think it has to be more than that. We'll find that out someday.
Have you seen the graph that somebody put together about the wealth of politicians versus individuals going back to the 1990s? I can find it real quick, I'm sure, if you haven't. It's mind-boggling.
Well, yeah, while you're looking for that, it would definitely pull this up. I just want to note that the final revision, so we got the jobs report, but they did this revision. The final benchmark revision for 2025 is like, minus 862,000. So largest downward revision since, 2009. What was going on in 2009?
Yeah.
Oh, that was the great financial crisis. That's right. So long ago. So this thing bothers me, Paul, because what they've had to do is they keep coming out with these Pollyanna reports. The market jumps. Like, I can show you some data that silver took a big dump because it was such a strong payrolls report. But Zero Hedge noting that out of the last 26 months, 25 have been revised lower. So, again, this just speaks to the McJobs angle, why I'm so dismissive of it, why I know it's a biased report, why I know it's not communicating or tracking reality. Because if it was honest, that would be 50-50. You know, half the time you have to revise up, half the time you'd have to revise lower. 25 out of 26 says we have a systematic bias in this to always report hot and then quietly take it off the table later on. And there you, yeah.
Well, and the average person hears the headline numbers. It's all over the news. It's all over the papers. It tells you how great things are. It's propaganda that feeds the narrative about how wonderful it is. And then they quietly go back and revise it. Excuse me. In the shadows. That's really what it is, because very few people are going back and taking a look at it unless they have somebody like you that's an information scout that's bringing it to their attention. But it matters. That's a rot under the surface, and we're looking at the markets. I mean, they're consolidating right now. Are they topping? I don't know. But we've not really gone anywhere except for bouncing around in noise for the past 4 months. That's telling us something, because you can hide those numbers, you can manipulate that, but you can't hide the impact of that in time. And then all of a sudden, we're going to get this impact to the markets, potentially, if we don't hyperinflate in the interim period, that's going to catch the average person off guard and unprepared, because they've been convinced that passive is the way to go.
Well, here it is, straight from the Department of Labor's website itself. And so it turns out they were only off last year. They only overestimated jobs by 1 million. Only so
only
close.
Only by 1 million.
Only by 1 million, you know. And so that's an issue, because, again, all of these things were driven. The algos would come in like, oh, a hot jobs report. That's good. Good news is good news. Bad news was good news. All of that other stuff, because maybe they'll cut faster, all of this and that. But bottom line is, it really feels like our instrumentation is off. Like, we're all flying in this plane together, and we've got this one little dial over here. It's employment. That's our altimeter. Dude, it's only off by, you know, a few thousand feet. Is that a problem?
Yeah. That's the difference between crashing the plane and not. When you can't trust your instruments, you're essentially flying blind. The good thing is price action still gives us a little bit of something that we can pay attention to, even though that can still be somewhat manipulated. And I did find this, Chris. It's quite fascinating.
Pull that up. Let's take a look.
So this was posted by American Ion Patriot, American AF, politicians versus the average person net worth starting in 1989.
Average net worth. Is that net worth that when they started the position, or?
Yeah, so they started the same in 1989.
Yep. Uh-oh. Blue line went the wrong way.
And look how it changed in 2009. Look at that. Just one more time.
Yeah.
So it goes into hyperdrive in 2008, 2009.
Wow. Great financial crisis was good. Good to Congress critters. Bad for the rest of us.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And you can see that the closer you are, obviously, the closer you are to the printing presses, the more beneficial that has become. And if you look at just the moral degradation of our politicians and the how they openly lie, there is no justice. I mean, that's going into a lot of pockets at the expense of the average person, substantially so. That's just incredible to me.
So that's part of the game. Let me show you the other part of the game that relates to that for me, Paul, is, okay, this is silver over the past 24 hours, and the same pattern's holding up. The rest of the world, the green arrow, is buying. This is when our markets are closed over here, and then the United States sells. But I did want to point out, this big red candle went from about 85.20 all the way down to 83.20. So $2 got shaved off of silver in a big volume spike, because the McJobs report came out, which is totally fake and will be revised lower later. When it gets revised lower later, Paul, you want to take a guess as to whether we'll get a $2 spike in silver to get that back?
Oh, no. No.
No, no.
Especially not when the U.S. markets are open. Whoever's dumped there is not going to be helping to fuel the price in the direction that it's obviously going over the long term.
Yeah. By the way, whole story I didn't prepare for today about silver and just how little there actually is, and big movements in China and COMEX. This is going to be quite the year in 2026 as these paper shenanigans, I think, finally get met with reality, which is we don't have that much stuff. The silver is really, really quite thin supply out there right now. And they're trying to pretend like you can just dump thousands and thousands of paper contracts and it's all, that's reality. I think reality comes to have a seat at the table this year, and it's going to have a seat at the table not just for silver, Paul, but for all commodities. I think we've got a date with reality coming up here soon.
It sure seems to be that way. It looks like, you know, the one constraint to this forever AI, everything else is going to be the actual materials that we need and how underinvested that is going forward. And then add on top of that, I heard a great statement the other day, and I wish I could remember who to get attribute it to. But the debasement trade's what's been, you know, working its way through the media everywhere else. And he said, yeah, it's a debasement trade in short bursts in the short run, but this is a debasement trend. There's a moving away from fiat currencies into real assets, because that's the one thing that we've underinvested in. It's basically supply and demand. And as the leaders in this market start to crack and the markets start to change, you're going to have that big reversion back to the mean into those commodities and real things, because that's what we need to pull off, you know, all of this great growth that they're claiming that we're going to have.
Now, if you want to really talk debasement, then, because they say, you know, we're in this fourth turning environment, right? And it's marked by the word crisis. And a key feature of crisis is loss of faith in institutions. But there's a flip side to that coin where, actually, Paul, I have a lot of faith. I have faith that my government's going to deficit spend until a disaster strikes. Yeah. I have faith that the Federal Reserve will open up its magic printing presses and make rich people even richer to combat some sort of crisis, because that's been my entire life. So I have faith that they're going to continue to do the wrong things for the wrong reasons going forward. Quote, the Raven just put this up last night. It turns out the U.S. has added $481 billion in debt in just 3 months, but over the last 7 months has borrowed an incredible $2.28 trillion. And there's a couple things I want to point out about this. All of these colors ranging from dark green to orange to purple to pink, those are actual marketable securities, so T-bills, bonds, notes. There's this green, this light green, that fluorescent green, that's called non-marketable. That's excess money that people have paid into Social Security that they've spent. And so they put special treasury bills over in the Social Security Trust Fund that are non-marketable. You can't sell those securities, right? They just exist on a balance sheet. You know, from one branch of the government takes it and puts it in the other branch. But they don't count that towards our deficit. And it's the weirdest thing, because, Paul, that would be like me writing a check. Pull a checkbook out of my left pocket, write myself a $1 million check and putting it in my right pocket and saying I'm a million richer. It just, nobody else can get away with this kind of accounting. You can't do that. But anyway, but $2.2 trillion, that's how much we've actually overspent over the past 7 months. But they don't count this light stuff in here as part of the problem, because that's money that came into the government and then they spent it anyway and just stuffed an IOU over there. So it didn't count. But it does count. That's how much we're deficit spending on a seven-month basis right now.
That's incredible. And no wonder gold, silver, and commodities in general are starting to move. No wonder emerging markets have come to life for money. People that understand where this trend is going and the reality of the situation are diversifying into other assets that tend to do much better when our dollar starts to fail.
And let's just even sort of visually compare to last year. This is January of 2025. But you see, you get numbers in here like 209, 136, 131. This only had a $2 billion net add, minus 1, minus 5. So you can sort of see what those numbers are. Look at these first months here, 357, 363, 403, 356. These are much higher numbers than they were over here. The trend is picking up. So you called it a debasement trend.
Trend.
There it is.
It sure is. And in a deceptive manner as well, right? Unless you're digging into, or somebody like Chris, what's his name? Quoth the Raven is digging into that.
Chris Irons, yeah.
Chris Irons, that's right. You're not seeing it. And watchmen are needed now more than ever for the average individual to really discern what's taking place, because there's so much noise. And that's one of the things I've been doing. I've just been really narrowing down for the past week and a half just to really focus on price action in the market to look for the signal within the noise, because there's unbelievable amounts of volatility taking place. There's unbelievable amounts of leadership change within the overall market. I mean, NASDAQ, as of before we started, was actually negative for the year. S&P basically flat. Gold's up substantially. Silver, even after its big shellacking, is still, you know, outperforming most all other assets year to date, emerging markets, commodities. And this is a trend that we can clearly see going back to the start of 2025 that's really gone into hyperdrive at the first part of this year. And I do believe that for those individuals that are adaptable, we're seeing more money move into that direction. That's why I like to watch price action so much in money flow, is because those big investors, they can't sell like an average investor can at the snap of a finger, or they'll crash the market. So they have to slowly work their way into those areas while, I believe, they market they take dollars. Instead of losing it and dumping it in the market, they market through the media. They market through all of these fancy products and social influencers to tell you that you need to buy what they're selling. And unfortunately, that's what I'm seeing in the price action. And look, is this a birth pain, or is this actually the birth of that reversion in the other direction? I don't know yet, but I can tell you the trend is clear. And that goes right in line with the debasement trend.
All right, Paul, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, though, I want to talk about that other data you had about the hiring for the youth. But beyond that, I think big money is leaving clear footprints as it moves into a sector. And so I want to talk about that just as soon as we come back. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, you mentioned it. This is actually, I caught both of our eyes. It's pretty dramatic. Kobayashi yes. Letter pushing up this chart here. So it says average starting salaries for college graduates is down another 8% year over year to $54,500, the lowest in at least 6 years. It marks the fourth consecutive annual decline. Salaries have plummeted minus 24% in real terms since the 71,000 peak seen in 2021. So graduates, college, not a positive ROI anymore, but this is a very bad trend. So that's, what are we even doing to our youth? What is even happening here? It's the most expensive market it's ever been for housing. We got inflation through the roof and all kinds of things. We're doing this to them?
Yeah. Cost of college education is at an all-time high. Vehicles, insurance, housing. And yeah, this is what's taking place. Is this really, we're hiring all of these educators to arm and train these kids for the workforce, and their initial starting salary is going down? I mean, what are we doing? And that's not a sign of a really strong housing market, or, you know, on the other side, a workforce that the employers see as valuable enough with the education that they have to pay them a premium to join their firms. It's it's just in every sector of our economy, we are leaving a horrible inheritance, a much less valuable inheritance to the generations that's up that that is arriving than what the baby boomers, the Generation X, and even the millennials have received.
This is a terrible trend right here. It's not good.
No.
And if you comprehensively undermine your next generations, right, that's no way to go through life, son. I mean, it's just obvious. Nobody, I think, no thinking person would say, yeah, this is a good plan. You know what we should do? We should make it really hard for the next generation to get started because money, because we have a money system that's just, I'm sorry, Paul, but we just have to print more money and throw it in the system, even though that preferentially goes to these billionaires who we found out through the Epstein files are not exactly the world's nicest, best people out there. So maybe they shouldn't be rewarded more. Maybe we should reward our youth more and those people less. But nothing you can do about it, Chris, because that's the system. And what are you going to do, right? Congress is going to vote itself, you know, higher incomes, however they get that, by hook or by crook. And so this is, I think, what's going to have to sort of come to a head at some point here is we have to have a real serious conversation about who we are and who we want to be, not and who we actually are, not who we think we are. Because it's, I don't know, this bothers me. You know what it's probably connected to, though, Paul? If you look here, starting in 2020, late 2021, the hiring rate has fallen really sharply over that same period of time that we see salaries going down. So this whole fiction about, oh, look how good, you know, our economy's strong. Trump has been out there saying, yeah, employment's great. Unemployment rate's kind of low. It's not actually in the data itself that we would look at here.
Yeah, and that's not a sign of a great economy. And look, maybe it's a sign that AI is eliminating that many jobs. Maybe that's the reality of what's taking place, or a combination of the both of two. But I mean, if AI is coming along that far, and that's what we're dealing with, does it make sense that college graduates should come out with these institutions that have these massive endowments, right? They're paying these huge premiums and they've got debt that they can't default on, right? You can't bankrupt on your student loan debt.
That's right.
But they're paying 9% and 10% interest on something that should carry no risk whatsoever. And look, I've run into situations and I've had people over the years, I always tell them, you know, don't borrow money for your kids' education because, you know, number one, they have the ability to sacrifice. It may take them longer to get out of school. They can work part time. You know, if you sign all those loans and the kids don't pay, and I've seen this on about five different situations, somebody's in retirement. The children quit paying on those notes. And guess what? Their Social Security is garnished going forward. And we're the rates are 9% and 10%, right? That just doesn't make sense. I mean, it seems like most of Wall Street is using the younger generation as a profit center to line their own pockets instead of really trying to do what's best for them across the board. And then you go back and look at the stats. I don't have it in front of me. The administrative level within the education system has ballooned over the past 15, 20 years, but the outcome for the students is far worse than what it was in the 80s and the 90s and wherever it is. So something has to break, and it will at some point in the future. If we don't deal with it now, I don't know how it's going to break, but it will break, because that generation, if they don't have anything to lose, then, you know, you don't know what they're going to do in response to that. And you look at the demoralization you've talked about, the drug rates, the suicide rates, you know, at what point do they start to rage against the machine? And I think we're closer to that every day.
Well, you know, we have this whole thing that we've built up over thousands of years, which is that you work to live, in essence, right? It's how you get food and put a roof over your head and all of that other stuff. Is you work, right? And we defined our meaning and purpose through work. Now, if we were a hunter-gatherer tribe, we might have meaning and purpose through, I don't know, ancient shamanic rituals or something, because apparently those people only had to work a couple hours a day to, like, meet their basic needs, you know? Now you have to work hard, right? And we found, listening to Professor Plum, Michael Green, that the cutoff line for what we might call survival in the United States might be as high as 140,000 a year. He suspected other people like, oh, no, it's a lot less than that, but it's definitely more than the official $31,200, you know, family of four rate for the federal government out there. So poverty is a poverty of not having your own time, being one slip up from disaster because, you know, money in, money out is just barely, your nose is just right at the waterline, you know, and you don't have any room for error in that. And that water is pretty high and it's rising rapidly too because of costs for things like property taxes, insurances, home health, auto, you know, all those. It's just there are all these things you can't really avoid because we've created that sort of society for ourselves. And then, you know, this is a crime scene. I'm going to show you a photo of a crime scene. Avert your eyes if you're squeamish. This is the largest real estate bubble in U.S. history, bar none.
Mm-hmm.
Brought to us courtesy of the Federal Reserve, deciding that house prices should go up, not down. Now, they had their reasons, and it created something called a home wealth effect, and people who felt wealthy in their homes would, you know, borrow against them and spend more. But it was basically just a ruse to get people to go into debt on the basis of an asset that isn't an asset, Paul. It's the place, like, you have to live in a house. You got, what are you going to do, camp out? You're going to live in a house.
Right.
That, and by the way, an asset is something that puts money in your pocket. My house just reliably takes money out of my pocket, making it a liability. So they actually said, we're going to cram your liabilities up and we want you to borrow against your liabilities, creating a further liability. That's what they did. And they did it, I submit to you, knowingly. And they're spiritually bankrupt, whoever these people are.
No, this is completely agreed. And look, and the sad part is I have the benefit of being in this industry for, what, 28 years now. You know, back in 2007, I saw people that, you know, justify, they're not making any more real estate. They're not doing this. This is great. I'm going to buy all these rental properties. I can't tell you how often I run into individuals from time to time that are wanting to buy rental properties, especially if they're loaning money and the math just doesn't work. Like, I mean, I literally have to put it on the grease board and say, okay, what's your plan? I mean, by the time you replace the roof, you've got a tenant that destroys a few things. The cost of your insurance is going up. Now, COVID and all the money that was injected into the system through that, VRBOs and the time to travel and moving, yeah, there was a flush that occurred there. But all that did was fuel people to go even stronger into that sector with much less fear and trembling because they're fully convinced that what they can see in the rearview mirror is what's going to continue going forward. And I, you know, that's a bubble that's going to hurt a lot of people when it bursts. And you're right. Your primary residence, one thing if you've got some rental property that's debt-free that's generating some income. I don't think it's going to be the asset going forward that people expect it to be if they're going off of hindsight bias, but that's a completely different thing. But one of the things I do when I run a retirement plan for people, I'm like, we don't count the value of your home. Yeah, I mean, that's on your profit, you know, that's on your balance sheet. That's a part of your net worth, but it's an income taker. If it doesn't put income into your pocket, that doesn't support your lifestyle in retirement. As a matter of fact, the bigger the house, the more expensive it is to take care of, the larger the roof, the more it is to insure it, the more it is to cover the electricity and the power, that cuts into your lifestyle. And I cannot tell you the people I've run into over time that just really thought that their house was their retirement vehicle and didn't do the math to understand how much it costs them to really live. And I'm like, look, you got one of two options. You're going to have to work another 10 years and you can retire at 75, or you're going to have to downsize that house. And I hate to have to deliver that, but it's the truth. I have to tell people about that. It's their decision to make. But you can just watch the you know, pain ripple across. They just lost a vision of their future of where they thought that it would be. And hey, if you want to keep it, work till you're 75. But right, or downsize now before prices crash, where you can make that shift. Problem is now houses are so expensive, a lot of people are stuck because they can't necessarily downsize because homes, you know, aren't as cheap as what they were at one time from the extremes.
No, I mean, if you sell your house, presumably you have to buy another house. But what's interesting, Paul, is I found that in a lot of areas in the country now, growing number, it's cheaper to rent than to own. Which is good for the renter, but it's bad for the homeowner who's the landlord, right? Because that means their carrying costs are now theoretically above a lot higher than they ought to be, right? It used to be, I don't know, I'm old enough, I think you probably are too, to know that the rule of thumb used to be 7 years, right?
Yes.
7 years. Yes. If I bought a house, it should pay for itself through rental income over the course of 7 years, which gives you that buffer you need to replace the roof and deal with the stuff that the renter's damaged and all that other stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you might just be barely breaking even, which is an infinity project. Like, it'll never break even, right?
You're
never
exactly
pay itself
right.
back.
I mean, in most areas, based on the rent that you're getting now, you're talking about a 20 to 30 year break even for the purchase. Now, in the 1990s, it was 7 years, and then it made sense to go to 10. And I remember my uncle, who passed away recently, he got into the rental market in the 80s and 90s, and he's like, hey, when I first started, it was a 5 year, and he gave me the formula in 1996. He's like, it's 7 years, and then by the year 2000, it turned to 10. Now it's 20 to 25, but the average individual doesn't look at it from the math like that. They look at someone that's been really successful in the rental market, and they go, I want to be that. I'm going to do what they did, but they don't understand the formula that they built their base on. And what's interesting to me right now is I'm seeing a lot of clients that were savvy. They did it on a mathematical formula that are selling their rentals right now. They're like, I don't necessarily know where to put the funds, because that's a hard decision to make right now. But they know that they are stating, they don't know, they suspect that where we are right now is unsustainable from a long-term standpoint. And I had a very interesting conversation with the client. Says, look, I've considered the hyperinflationary scenario. He's like, in the next 5 to 10 years, I've got to replace the roof. I've got to replace a lot of things that are with this house. I've got to put a lot of money into it. He said, I know the argument of hyperinflation being good for the asset. He said, but what if we have rent controls? I can't increase my rent, but it costs me 5 times, 10 times, 20 times to replace that roof. I'm not willing to take that chance right now. And they're freeing that capital up to go somewhere else.
Mm, that's an interesting point. Now, so back to this chart. What's one of the consequences of forcing people to buy at the bubble top? Well, it gets a lot of people in trouble. So, Paul, this just came out. It turns out that 14 from Darth Powell, Vlad the Inflator, 14% of the 8.2 million FHA home loans are now delinquent. 14%.
That's substantial.
That is a big number. I wonder how many of those were people who, remember we had the ninja loans, no income, no job, you know, loans. I wonder how many of these were like no proof of citizenship loans. That now they've bailed, and guess what? They're past due.
That's a really good point.
I wonder.
So let's assume that 8.2 million people can't afford those notes because they're behind, they're delinquent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're defaulting on your home as expensive as homes are right now, and especially if you have lower rates, you don't have a choice. You just can't pay for that home. What in the world is going to happen to the housing market if 8.2 million homes come to market with all that's under construction right now? That's just basic supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unsustainable environment.
Well, it is. That's a severe sign of stress. And, of course, we've talked about this one before, too, which is it just keeps going up, which is commercial mortgage-backed securities. This is office space. So, obviously, post-COVID, nobody really wanted to go back to offices. It's one of the deadest things out there on the market right now. But as you and I have talked about it, Paul, that's a huge, very rapid pace of change, obviously, worse than the financial crisis, worse than the oil bust, worse than the recession. Back there in the early 2000s, one of the worst readings we've ever seen. Who's eating the losses? That's somebody's got a lot of losses on their books, and I'm not sure who that is at this stage. Worries me.
That's a really good question. And one thing that I want to point out for the listeners, the spike in the 2000 to 2012 was after the damage done from 2007, 2008. The market actually anticipated that. So that didn't really start spiking until 2009, and the damage had already been done in the markets, and that was just the after effect that rippled through.
Yeah. It peaked out there from 2011 to 12 and didn't start going down until 2013.
Yes. So what is that telling us about how complacent the markets are right now and the financial institutions or investors in general when that default rate, the delinquency rate, is higher than it was at the worst part of the hangover of the 2008 bust, and the markets are just sitting here flirting at all-time highs? I mean, that's That's just another pillar. We're not sitting on an economy of a stone or rock foundation. It's like the three little piggies. We're sitting in a straw house right now that's built on sand. So it's the worst of both combinations. And that's just telling us right now that it's not going to take much when those losses come to life, and who's allowing them to be hidden. Because I've not seen major write-offs with any major institutions at this point, outside of some that's taken place in private equity.
Yeah, we're seeing a little in private equity, private credit. More broadly, you know, I don't see huge signs. We're not at super stress levels here right now on consumer delinquencies, but you will notice that they tend to go down, and then they started to rise into the great financial crisis. We're rising again. And by the way, they haven't been here in about a decade at this particular level. So this, just to be clear, just sitting right at about 5% is right about here. That's coming up into that period of, which, you know, it's a great financial crisis. And by the way, severely derogatory. I mean, that's very bad. Like, no, not going to get that back. That's the fattest wedge in here. But look at the 120 plus days late, Paul. Mm-hmm. That's the fastest rising wedge on here right now.
It sure is.
So we're starting to see there's some signs there. It's not pull the ripcord emergency, but it's definitely something to keep your eye on. It's kind of headed the wrong way there. Maybe we don't have a consumer economy anymore, and consumers are irrelevant. I don't know. But we do have a speculative economy, and I want to go to this one last thing before we turn to what I think is going to be the biggest investment thesis for a while, to be positive about all this. $1.3 trillion, according to FINRA, in margin debt. Paul, this is really astonishing, this spike in borrowing to just pile into equities right now. I've been reading constantly that, like, you know, there was this big rumble we talked about last week in the SaaS, software as a service companies. Apparently, retail bought those hand over fist. We're seeing people are really, really taking a flyer at this one. And maybe they have the same faith I do that the Fed will have your back and print this out. So don't worry about it. Just go long, go longer. They got your back. Nothing bad could happen. What could go wrong?
What is it? Who was it? Was it Thomas Jefferson said, first by inflation, then by deflation, they will rob you of all your wealth?
Mm-hmm.
That's something we have to take into consideration. And that speculative fever, I mean, there's no concern with those individuals to carry that much margin debt to invest right at all-time highs. When what I'm seeing, and I don't know how this unfolds, but we're near 6 months now in an area of congestion where we're just bouncing back and forth like a ping pong ball. And that tells me that you know, the market's concerned about something. Now, can the Fed kick the can down the road? Is Warsh going to be as dovish as what they say? I don't know. But at a time where the market is acting incredibly different than what it has for most of last year, investors are piling all in because on margin, because they're fully convinced that they're going to that prices are going to go higher, and it may not be so.
All right, Paul, when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. I want to talk about this. Something is really happening here that I want to alert people to, and I believe that there's always a bull market somewhere, no matter how weird things get, and that's always true. I'm not for sure saying there's one here, but man, we got some signs to talk about this as soon as we come back. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, oil, you know, one of my favorite topics. Here's what's weird to me. When I look at this chart of oil, this is a weekly, going back to on your left would be 2021. That spike in there was in 2022, where it was hanging out around 120 a barrel. It's been pretty much, I look at this chart, I'm not bullish. I look at this chart and I'm like, kind of a downsloping wedge, hasn't broken out. Really nothing's happened here. It's bounced off of the bottom channel for now. I mean, from a chart standpoint, am I missing something here?
No, I mean, look, if it was a sharp descending wedge or a sharp ascending wedge, descending versus ascending, I could place a bet. In that case, you just have to wait. Like the market's just waiting for a breakout, a catalyst in one direction or the other. Now, I would think based on that wedge and what I'm seeing take place in commodities in general, that's going to break out to the top side. But it's just a little noise in that range right now with no signal yet.
Well, here's my thesis. Big money starts moving before the signal actually comes out. Okay.
Yes, they do.
Yep. And if you're going to be big money, you don't usually just buy oil directly because it's a consumable. You buy the companies that are involved in producing the oil. So this is why this really caught my attention here. According to bar chart, energy stocks going for the eighth consecutive green week matched the longest winning streak in almost 2 years. So this is like, but more importantly, there's a line here. This is a breakout. Now that I can spot. Like there was clear resistance. You can even see there was this beautiful rising wedge right here and it broke out. So why are energy stocks breaking out when this is what energy itself looks like? I submit, I guess we're going to see a breakout here too, but you see it here first.
Very good explanation, Chris, because that's a bit of information right there. And that's one thing that I think you and I talked about it at some point. I was talking about somebody yesterday. Several years ago, gold had a major breakout. And then back about a year ago, I think it was March, May, April of last year, silver had a major breakout after a consolidation. The breakout that's taken place in that energy sector is major from a long-term standpoint. So, yes, that's one bit of information that tells us it's highly likely that you're going to see oil prices break out of that wedge to the upside.
Now, as I've gone over this at length with Adam Rosenschwag of Gehring and Rosenschwag, but one of the things is that most markets are narrative driven, and the narrative that the International Energy Agency, which is the IEA, they've been just bearish and bearish and bearish. There's this oil glut. We've got a huge oil glut, giant oil glut. Demand is going to be really low. Supplies are going to be really high, millions of barrels per day, too much. And they've been running that for a long time, and they just quietly had to sort of like back off of that and say, oops. You know, no oil glut. But that narrative structure got us to the point, I think you and I have discussed this before, that energy stocks were now like 2.3% of the S&P, which is crazy because this is where everything comes from energy. Germany's figuring this out. People will figure this out. Energy is kind of the thing and all the rest is possible because you have the thing. If you don't have that thing, I mean, what are AI data centers? Paul, they're giant toaster ovens. They don't make toast. We feed energy in and they make waste heat, right?
Right.
We should probably learn how to make toast out of that too, get a twofer out of that. You know, yeah. AI data center and bakery. It'd be amazing. But no, energy's everything. And it's just the most hated, overlooked thing. And I think that's what we're seeing here is like it's going to start catching some attention. It's got somebody's attention, right? Very quietly. I'm not reading about this in the news or not mentioning this. On CNBC,
look, that's been on my radar. I mean, we've had several conversations about it in the investment committee, and anyway, I can't get into that here. But the reality is, that's a massive signal. And Chris, here's the thing: you're going to hear about it all over the media. It's going to be all over the papers. It's going to be easy to buy when the big money's selling. But they're going to move under the stealth of they're going to move undercover. They're going to move in darkness. They're moving where the ball's going to be 2 to 3 years from now, and they've got the patience to wait it out. And I think that's one of the reasons because, you know, look, I've said it before. I thought crypto was a release or relief valve. You know, it was a distraction for the retail investor to go after while the big institutions were accumulating your metals. So in this case, I think that we've got all kinds of distraction while the big investors are moving into your commodities, your emerging markets, and the other areas of where it looks like we're going over the next 2 to 3 years, especially if the debasement trade is a trend, and it looks like it is. And look, what do you want to own? What do you want to own if we're in a debasement trend? You want to own the things that take, you want to own energy, and you want to own the materials and the commodities that that energy has to be used for to extract. And that's a big breakout. I mean, it's been on my radar. It's one of the reasons I've just been focusing, trying to cut out the noise and say, okay, what is it telling us right here? And what's the wise application in a portfolio of how do you utilize this now? Because we have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. But then there are periods of time where you get signals and say, okay, the rules of the game are changing right now, and you can start to see that around the edges, and there's signals like that that tell you it's time to make a few different decisions with your portfolios.
Well, and again, this is not any particular recommendation for or against any particular share. I just want to illustrate what I'm talking about more precisely here. So this is ExxonMobil Corporation, obviously one of the biggest oil producers out there, up another 2.8% today. But look where it was, Paul, for the past year. It's basically been bouncing between 100 and about 117 or 15 or so. I mean, that's just been doing like nothing, just bounce up, down, going nowhere. But then right here, right about it towards the end of last year, December, it makes this little breakup, tests back down right here, and it's been nothing but up since 2026. That's what I call the stealth accumulation. Again, there's not a lot of news about this. CNBC isn't really talking about it, but this is one of your better performing stocks out there by any measure, and it's doing very, very well, but the oil isn't doing all that well. So prediction, we're going to see the price of oil move up a lot, and somebody knew about it in advance. That's how I read this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, can we talk about what... So this is one of my favorite subjects. You know, I get all excited about this.
Yes.
Oil is everything, right? This is a chart from my book, The Crash Course, and I just love this one. It says, look, starting in about 1975, this dot would have been how big was the global GDP in trillions of dollars? And then that's on the y-axis, and on the x-axis would have been, well, how many barrels of oil did the world consume that year? So each dot is a year that's showing us GDP and oil consumption, and this is almost a straight line. An R squared of 0.93, which means it has 93% explanatory power. So that if you said, Chris, I'm going to give you one number. I'm going to tell you how big the economy was that year. With 93% accuracy, I can tell you how much oil the world consumed that year, or vice versa, right? So that's all. And it's just a very, very nice tight line, which should be obvious. If you want to have an economy, you're going to burn oil. You're going to transport things, you're going to mine things, you're going to fashion them, you're going to make fertilizer, you're going to plow fields, you're going to move cars, you're going to take vacations, oil. Makes sense when you study it. But most people don't look at it that way. They look at the GDP, they look at the dollar number, not the connection to the oil number. So, great. So we need a lot of oil. Now, the EIA in their January report, it's called the Short-Term Energy Outlook, the STEO, they came out and they said, all right. Alaska, you can see here, it's basically doing like you can almost ignorable. It's a flat line. It produces a little bit more. The Gulf of Mexico, it's not doing bad, but it's kind of flat. The whole growth has been in these Permian region and the other shale basins here. And you can see at this dotted line at the beginning of 2026, this now starts to go backwards. You can see for the total United States, it's going backwards. It's been going up the whole time. Now it's going backwards. This is the story that the market has not publicly digested on CNBC, but I submit to you it's beginning to privately digest in the energy stocks. And this is what it looks like in a very nice, colorful chart by Tavi Costa and Azuria Capital put this out. But if the line is red, the United States is producing less oil that year, and so we had this big crater due to COVID starting in 2020. And if it's a green line, it means we're producing more oil. And we have our first decline, and we've just slipped down, but you can see the trend here coming back for the past few years, and this is going to be red as far as the eye can see now. That's a big deal. That is a really big deal. Because the United States is going to have to import oil, and we're going to be in competition with the rest of the world for imported oil. Right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you compete? Usually with money, although Trump did a little something different with Venezuela. You know, that's another way.
Not funny, but yeah.
I'm not sure it's a long-term viable strategy to do it that way, but...
Well, when you see that data, it Venezuela makes them a lot more sense, right?
Yeah.
It does. It's just a clear piece of data to say, here's a bit of evidence that makes sense on those actions, whether you agree with them or not. I'm not saying I agree with them. I'm just saying that that helps explain the reality of what may be taking place. And look, if AI is going to destroy that many jobs, the debt overhang that we have within the country, the margin debt that's out there, that's why I'm concerned about the potential for a deflationary impulse before we get the worst part of the debasement with our currency over time, is something is going to have to snap in there. And individuals are so casual about leverage with what you showed in that chart earlier about margin debt, that they're not recognizing what's taking place because they've been convinced, and understandably so, that, you know, because of the exterior forces kicking this can down the road, that we're just going to be passive and everything's going to be okay. I can't tell you how many times in the past couple of weeks the average investor, now, the individuals that I'm meeting through here, they're aware, but the average investor is like, you know, has told me several times in conversations around town, it's like, yeah, this volatility is a little scary, but the market always goes up. And, you know, and I ask the question, I'm like, always? Are you familiar with history? And they're like, always. And I'm like, yeah, it always does. It always has, at least in the past, if you have a 25-year time horizon. But what's going to happen to you if you're 70, 75, 65? And they can't print our way out of it because of all of the other forces, and we have a deflationary impulse and then a hyperinflationary holocaust on the other side. You don't have time to recover like these major institutions do with an infinite timeline.
You do not. And by the way, there's something larger here. So I get it. Listen, we're at a very big inflection point here. And generally speaking, people have been right. It does go up, right, over time, partly because of inflation, but partly because we're actually growing our economy, becoming more efficient and productive, right? I mean, airplanes, making an airplane today is a totally different prospect than 100 years ago, right? So obviously it's a much better thing. Through that whole sweep of time, Paul, what we've always had is more energy available to us. And this is kind of the prime conclusion I come to in the crash course. But as you know, I have this new, I'm taking this year over at Peak Prosperity, and I'm refashioning how I do things. I'm taking these larger deep dive reports. And the one I did this last month for January is called When Money Dies, right? So this is something we have to talk about, because our money system is predicated on this idea of always continual growth, the thing your clients are saying. Yeah, things just always grow. They always grow because we've always had more energy there, right? Even with the, you know, we had the oil crisis of 1973, that was geopolitical. OPEC said, we're turning the taps off, we're mad about this war in Israel, right? Okay. But now we're facing something different. We're not facing geopolitical risks to oil, it's geological risks. Totally different scenario. And look, we might make it through it with, you know, some things will arise and humans are clever. But right now, I can tell you with full authority, if they have plans for how we're going to get through this, they're not sharing them with the public, because I scoured. They're not. I don't think they have them, because if they did, I probably would know about them. They don't have a plan for this at this stage that I'm aware of. So you're going to print more and more and more money, but you're not going to have as much of the juice you need to make use of that money. We call that inflation. That's what happens next.
Yes, more money chasing fewer goods, and if that output goes down, how high can it go before we reach equilibrium?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question.
Yep. I think that double hump inflation we talked about is going to come. And by the way, I don't know what to make of this yet, but to continue the oil story very quickly, this is OPEC countries. So the OPEC plus G8 is crude production. But here's the production quota. So they set the production quotas, which are the blue lines. You can see here, March of 25, they were actually overproducing. In April, they were overproducing. They matched it pretty darn good in May of 25, pretty close in June of 25. slightly producing a little bit less than quota in July of 25. By August, same thing, little underproduction. September, not bad, pretty close. Uh-oh. October, producing a lot less than quota. And November, December, and now January. If you see what I see, Paul, it might be that OPEC is would like to produce more, but maybe it can't produce more at this point in time. It's a possibility. It might just be that they're withholding it for other market reasons, but this is a big giant gap right here, and it's getting wider. And more to the point, it's going down. The world is not, if OPEC plus G8 is heading down, the world is not ready for this at this point. We don't have a good plan for this. So that's why I think when you start to see oil stocks really beginning to move, I think somebody's beginning to digest this information. And the only way we can get more oil out of the ground, but not at this price, not at 60, 65 a barrel. We can get a lot more oil out of the ground at $110 a barrel. At 200, we'll get even more out of the ground. I mean, so that's the thing about, there's no such thing as running out of oil. It's at what price? We're out of oil at this price. That's what this is saying.
It sure is.
So the price of oil is going to go up.
And look, I would assume inflation has been on a global scale. Their cost of extracting that out of the ground is substantially higher right now than what it was 5 or 6 years ago. And if you know that you've got that imbalance, look, the shrewd thing to do is let's just leave it in the ground until the price gets to the point that we need to pull it out. So maybe that's what it's telling us right there. That's a very interesting analysis, quite frankly.
Yeah. And it's possible, as Josh Young is suggesting here, it's that the spare capacity numbers are grossly overstated. But worse than that, it kind of looks like you could sort of begin to make an argument for, have we rolled over here? You know, that's a very different story from we can constantly ram up our production as high as we need to. And by the way, the International Energy Agency has been saying, oh, there's a glut, there's a glut, there's a glut, there's a glut, there's a glut. The problem is, when Eric Nuttall adds it all up, you find out that global inventories have fallen by 14 million barrels year to date here on February 4th. In contrast, the IEA says the most anticipated oil supply glut in history, trademark, is forecasting Q1 builds of 4.25 million barrels per day. So far, they're off by 146 million barrels. Where is it? This line should be going like this if we had a big oil glut, right? That's what should be happening. 2020 is this purple line. That's an oil glut. Because we shut the whole world economy down, or a significant portion of it. And so, we don't see that. So it's not in the data, but they've been talking the narrative. And that's where you have investment opportunities, is when the story is wrong and the reality is something else. And I don't know when the IEA is going to catch up to the fact that the data refuses to confirm their story, but it's coming.
Well, and that data that you've been pointing out for quite some time, and even our analysis, is the reason why we rolled out that energy stock strategy last year. And it's fascinating to me to see what the targets are in the portfolio of the universe that we have. And there are times when the opportunity from a long-term perspective is so clear, you have to build special ideas for them. And that's the reason we rolled out the mining, you know, a little over a year ago, and then the energy last year in 2025, because it's just math when you look at it from a long-term perspective. You take the math, the underinvestment, the declining production rates that you're showing, and the debasement potential trade, and then the government potentially continuing to inflate dollars or yield curve control, or however they're going to try to kick the can down the road. It's an unusual investment opportunity from a long-term standpoint that you have to be in a position to take advantage of, to look where you're going, not where we've come from, right? Where you come from can give you some indication of where we might be going in the future, but the markets are at historic highs in valuations. I mean, in any of the measures of where we've been for the S&P 500 throughout history, we've never had a 10-year period of time where we had a positive return in the general market when it is this overvalued. But you take anything in the energy sector from that standpoint, they are so beaten up, overlooked, underinvested. You've had political pressures against them. You remember back during the Biden years where they had, what was it they called the the profits, the extra profit tax that they had talked about on the energy producers.
The windfall tax. The
windfall profit
tax.
Yeah,
remember those?
Yes, the windfall tax, right? I mean, if you're a big investor and you're going to run the risk of investing into an area because you see opportunity, but then the government can specially tax you because you've been in the right place, that just keeps capital from going in that area. So this appears to be, for those who are patient, not a recommendation, just a conversation, an unusual opportunity from a long-term perspective with some of the capital. Because if we're reverting and you see some of those technologies start reverting down as a percentage of the S&P, we're at what, historic lows with energy as a percentage allocation in the S&P? Mm-hmm. Can you remember where we were in 2007 when oil peaked in or summer of 2008? It was what, 14% of the S&P?
It was high. I don't know if it was that high, but I've got a number somewhere close to 10 in my head, but I could be wrong. It could be that. 13?
Yeah.
Somewhere there in zone. But like a 5-6 bagger from here, right?
Right.
On a relative basis. Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that. Now, to your point, the UK, which is busy trying to ruin itself, and they're doing a great job. I mean, really spectacular. They passed one of those windfall taxes, a 30% profit tax on North Sea oil producers. Guess what? Nobody's drilling any more oil.
You can't blame them.
It doesn't pencil out anymore. They take all the risk. They hit a dry hole. The government doesn't give you money back. But if you do hit, we're going to take 30% of that. So it takes whatever the potential returns were and just shaved 30% off. Most of these things have IRRs that are in the 20s. So you put 30 on top of that, they go negative real quick. And guess what? People don't drill. It's weird. The only person who can't understand that is a government minister.
I guess it's harder for them to circle money back into their own pocket through the drilling.
Yeah.
At least for now.
Well, all of oil is really just a story of supply and demand. So this is coming into 2026. You can see here that this is refinery demand. This would be 21 million barrels. We're right in range. There's no decline in oil demand. This is 2020 down here, obviously, this stupid thing. But otherwise, that's it. The United States consumes, on average, very noisy, 20, 21, 22 million barrels per day, which, by the way, you would want to have a lot of oil in storage. Our crude commercial stocks are banging around at the 5-year lows here, 10-year lows. So we don't have a lot of oil in stock. Diesel, mid to low. Gasoline, that's in the high end. Total inventories, kind of on the bottom end of the range. So we're not coming into this with a lot of We don't have deep stocks, and by the way, now we're going to be producing less oil on a go-forward basis. And again, I think that's what's being sniffed out in the energy sector stocks, is the fact that's no way to go through life, son. You know, Biden drained the SPR. Trump he's done a little refilling, but not like you would want, you know.
I was going to ask you about that, if you knew where that was.
I think it's up 30, 40 million barrels from the all-time low, but we need another 300 million in there. We don't need 40. We need 300, you know, to get that sort of back up. And by the way, that isn't oil. We keep different grades in there, and they've been refilling it with what they call light sweet, which is coming. We actually really need medium sour. That's what our refineries are tuned for, particularly along the Gulf Coast. But that's what we can get out of Venezuela. So I don't know. Maybe somebody has a plan. I hope. Mm-hmm. And Alberta fits into this, by the way. I don't know if you've seen, but United States officials are having talks with the Albertan separatists, because Alberta, Canada, is the province that produces nearly 100% of Canadian oil. And they produce a lot. Oil, gas, very resource-rich part of the country. And they're fed up with how Ottawa and the rest of Canada sort of, you know, just bleeds them dry and gives very little back, except stern lectures on how they need to be more less racist or whatever this is going on right now. So they're actively exploring separatism, not necessarily joining the U.S., but just becoming their own sovereign, which I would support. Because if they were their own sovereign on a oil per capita basis, they would be the richest country on the planet.
Wow. No wonder they're interested.
Yeah. They're nowhere close to that mark, right? They could be up there with Qatar, UAE, Norway. You know, they could be fabulously wealthy for a long time if they chose that path.
That's going to be on my radar from this point forward now.
Well, they had discussions because the government of Canada won't allow them to put a pipeline out to the coast for environmental reasons. You know, so they put it on trains, which makes no sense. But it means that they can't produce and ship and get a good price for their product. Western Canada Select WCS is usually at a discount, 10, 14, sometimes as high, depending on the day, $20 a barrel compared to world standards, because it's so hard to get it out of there and get it anywhere. So the government of Canada won't allow them to produce and then ship their stuff, so it keeps them sort of throttled. And, of course, the discussion they would have is, well, then they can just come right across the border of Montana and just get a pipeline. And if we allowed them to do that, they could probably be, you'd see people riding around on snowmobiles with, like, you know, wearing chic outfits. It'd be amazing. Flapping in the breeze, you know.
Yeah, they'd have gold trapper hats on.
Exactly. It'd be amazing.
That's great. But, you know, all I can think is you're pointing just out the math and what's taking place, and even that movement in Alberta. We're on the verge of monumental shifts under the surface of the market. And look, I don't know how it unfolds. You just have to adapt as information comes along and shift funds to take advantage of opportunity. But it's the volatility we've seen in the markets here recently. And the average investor looks at the overall S&P 500 and doesn't realize what's taking place. But, I mean, it's been sector by sector by sector. Somebody's just rolling through and doing a lot of damage under the surface of the market. And that tends to proceed. It's like tremors before a major earthquake. And I don't know how this year pans out, but I can certainly see we're at great risk of these markets topping with what's been taking place here recently. And look, a big push in energy is just going to further exacerbate that's like throwing gasoline on the coals of a fire that seems to be dying down, the inflationary pressures that we already see economically right now. I mean, if oil doubles in 6 months, and I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but if it does, that just exacerbates the already persistent inflation that's causing a lot of angst for the average individual.
No, it's a very good point here. So again, just to carry it on, hidden behind my thing, let me take myself out of here so we can just make this full size then. So this is year-to-date performance of all the stocks that make up the market, all the big ones. So you can see, we talked about this before, Paul, there's been a big rotation over to what we call consumer defensive, Walmart, Coke, P&G, stuff like that. Microsoft took a big hit, Palantir's taken a hit, Oracle. So you can see tech is actually down on the year. Flat for Google, tiny bit up for Apple, down for Amazon, down tiny bit for Tesla. But look at this bad boy, 29.5% year to date for Exxon, 21 for Chevron. The oil and gases are all, this is sneaking. So somebody's sneaking into this place here. And that's typical consumer defensive, right? When you get the rotation, when you're worried about a topping process, institutions, they go for real estate investment trusts. They go for consumer defensive. They go for their real estate utilities and sometimes energy, but basically these are your defensive plays. This is your swing for the fences place over here. And by the way, the software companies just got toasted despite the retail catching those knives. You can see the shift left to right, you know? Mm-hmm. So I look at that.
And if we're in a long-term trend, that lower right-hand box down the road is going to be as big as the top left-hand box from my view of looking at it.
Yeah. The
you know, it'll be a larger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As it should be, because it's so important to everything.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so you get a sense of shifting defensively, but also kind of stasis elsewhere, you know, just sort of bouncing along, upping and downing, that whole thing. So who knows? Such a mystery. Keeps you on your toes.
It does. But, and this is the point that I just want to warn individuals out there right now. Again, look. We don't know how long this momentum can carry. Math hasn't mattered in the general market because you've had outside forces that have been pushing. The question is, can they continue to print? Can they slam rates to zero without allowing inflation to just absolutely get out of control or crater the dollar? That seems to be a much harder circumstance right now. So if we are the point where there's not much else they can do and they've got to allow some deflation in the interim period to provide cover to print this money that we know they all are just itching to be ready to do, what does that do to your employment situation? What does that do to you individually? You know, I encourage and I'll still encourage individuals, if you're running a passive strategy, have 24 months worth of your funds set aside in an emergency fund. Okay. You don't want to get into a situation to where the market's at its worst point, you didn't have enough emergency funds and you're forced to sell when most people should be buying. Okay. And for those that are running an active risk managed strategy, it's a little more comfortable coming down to 12 months, but I still like you being in the 24-month area because you've just got some funds set aside that if we have a recession at some point in the next 12 to 24 months, or if these markets come apart and you survive it, AI doesn't take your job, or you don't have layoff, or your company doesn't go bankrupt because they're over-levered, right? Then that's money that you can deploy to try to bottom fish down the road. Right now is a time with this much complacency. Crypto has given us a major warning. That's upset a whole lot of individuals. Gold and silver has given us a major warning because there's a tremendous amount of demand going in there. Consumer staples, you know, defensives are giving major warnings right now. So I encourage people, put yourself in a strong financial position to where you can weather a storm coming forward, especially if you're passive. The, you know, worst case scenario, you come through it, the markets are down, your portfolio's down and you're passive. You don't have to use that emergency fund, but yet it's opportunity money to buy low when most people are being forced to sell. And if you don't have any funds available to take advantage of opportunity, then you're just going to have to ride through whatever's there and hope that you're not forced to sell. I saw way too many people that were complacent in 2007, 2008, even 2000 to 2003. It doesn't even have to be that 2008 type calamity that they were forced to sell investments that did good over the long term because they didn't have adequate emergency funds set aside because their greed had them, you know, lean towards being fully invested at all times, right? Wall Street's rarely going to tell you to keep 24 months in emergency fund because that's fees, that's money they can't get fees off of. I mean, I hate to be cynical, but that's the reality. So just prepare yourself. I mean, we're seeing volatility under the surface, and who knows? But history's given us tons of warnings time and time again. When there's this much margin debt, there's this much euphoria around the markets, there's this much complacency, that's usually the most dangerous time for your investment portfolio. So, you know, please, you know, at least you have been warned. Make sure that you're resilient. And I believe that that goes further than just your emergency fund. Make sure you've got food available. You know, there's all kinds of geopolitical things taking place. Go back to COVID and remember what happened during the supply. It was artificial, but just-in-time inventory meant there were things that you couldn't get. Make sure while things are good right now, peel some off of there and build resiliency within your financial portfolio and with your own, within your own personal life for yourself and your family and your community.
Very well said. And for anybody who wants to talk with Paul and or his amazing team, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out the very simple form. Somebody from Paul's team will be in touch with you within 48 business hours to begin a process. That if it goes the whole process is three calls, an introductory call, a planning call, and if it goes that far, you get to a recommendations call. And then after that, if that all seems to square up, I guess you and Paul and his team might work together. So that's the process. Whether you choose to work with Paul and his team or not, the process is totally worth it. That's the feedback I keep getting. And it is really an incredibly good process. So, Paul, thanks for offering that to people. And, yeah, everybody, please, trade safe, be safe, and keep your eye on the ball. Bye for now.